Welcome, listeners. John Fetterson here with you from the North Carolina Reading Service, reading The Independent, The Indie Week for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And this issue is dated April the 24th of 2025. Okay, music down. John Fetterson begins reading the Indie Week this week for you. And let's begin with a town hall, report of a town hall meeting, and that was in Pittsburgh by Valerie Fouché, Triangle Congresswoman. In her first in-person town hall of the second Trump era, Fouché did not unveil any magic solutions for the countless concerns raised by her progressive constituents, but as she fielded questions about Social Security, Veterans Affairs, and education, she was able to offer some small reassurances. She told a group of about 70 people at the end of the hour-long event in Pittsburgh's courthouse, "We've talked about what it means for this country to stay great. America's already great. We just need to make sure it stays great for everybody, including people like yourselves who are experiencing something you had nothing to do with causing." Fouché was joined by Chatham County Commission Chair Karen Howard and State House Democratic Leader Robert Reeves. While Fouché has held virtual town halls via phone call and showed up to cut the ribbon at Carborough's new library, Tuesday was the first time this year she's taken questions directly from constituents in her district. Her office posted the full recording online. This, by the way, is attached to a website. If you went to indieweek.com, you could find this article and then find the entire recording if you wished. What actions will Fouché take to save the Food and Drug Administration? What can a high school teacher tell his students about the future of science? What's happening with federal Pell grants and who is even handling them? Why don't other members of Congress care that their power is being seized by the executive? The constituents, for the most part, seemed to want to know that someone was still fighting for them. Fouché was at her strongest as she told attendees that many Republicans in Congress also don't like what's going on. They're just afraid of speaking out against it, saying, "We need to find some Republicans who believe their constituents deserve the same clean air, the same clean water, the same life-saving medicines we believe that all of you deserve. We need Republicans with a backbone to say we should not forget the least, the lost, and the left behind." Joe English, a Durham constituent at the event, said he was impressed by her presence. Quote, "You saw in her eye the passion, the care she has not only for the people in the district, but for America." Still, he said, Fouché could do more. He pointed out the event only lasted for an hour, and at the end of the event, he stood up and asked Fouché why more people weren't allowed in, saying, "There's a lot of people who are on the wait list I know that wanted to come and would have come, and I think they would have filled out the house." A staffer stepped in swiftly and expertly to tell English that she would connect with him afterward. The online registration for Tuesday's event did quickly fill up, with aspiring registrants redirected to a wait list, but the courthouse clearly could have fit dozens more. Fouché staff, they had been letting people off the wait list throughout the day, and that the courthouse in the far corner of the district was the best space they could reserve on short notice. And Fouché told the crowd, "It won't be a one-off. I do have four counties, so I'm trying to give all of my constituents the opportunity to engage." No member of Congress's seemingly impotent Democratic minority has figured out an effective and actionable plan for resisting Trump's vicious 100-day agenda. Locally, residents have taken the do-whatever-you-can approach, including cheerful songwriting, solo protesting, and organizing against immigration crackdowns. Everyone seems to be seeking, above all else, a reassurance that they are not alone. Fouché, despite her progressive voting record and safely ultra-blue district, isn't exactly an inspirational firebrand. Indy recently reported on fired federal workers' criticism of Fouché's response to the dismantling of American foreign aid, which has had an especially severe impact on the cuts on North Carolina. That's the state ranking as the fourth highest recipient of U.S. aid funding nationwide, with Fouché's fourth district ranking fourth among all 435 districts in the country. After the town hall, Fouché announced an in-person federal employee resource and listening session for Saturday in Durham. For those who want Fouché to engage more with constituents and take their concerns to Washington, her actions this week look like a step in the right direction. Next to Durham, former Durham Deputy Police Chief Shari Montgomery today filed discrimination charges with the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, alleging she was systematically sidelined and ultimately fired for being black and for raising concerns about her boss. Montgomery, a 25-year veteran of the department who became deputy chief in early of 2021, claims in her EEOC filing her troubles began that year when then-city manager Wanda Page sought her input on police chief candidates. When asked about Patrice Andrews, who would eventually be selected for the position, Montgomery expressed concerns about what she described as a pattern of, quote, inappropriate conduct by Andrews, which she believes Page then shared with Andrews. In an email to Indy, Durham Director of Public Affairs Beverly Thompson wrote, quote, the city has not received a notice from EEOC regarding these charges and allegations against the police department, so we cannot comment at this time. Durham Police Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The complaint alleges a three-year campaign of professional isolation followed, culminating in her being fired last week. Montgomery, who served as interim police chief before Andrews was hired and did not seek the permanent position, claims she was removed from leading the department's high-profile investigative services division, reassigned to field operations overseeing 9/11 calls, and excluded from strategic decisions typically involving someone of her rank. Things came to a head in October of 24 when Montgomery was abruptly placed on administrative leave. According to her EEOC filing, she was initially accused of unauthorized communication with officers about an internal affairs matter, with additional charges following in November, including allegations that she mishandled disciplinary record procedures a decade ago. She stated in her filings, I was placed on desk duty and assigned menial administrative work in the property and evidence unit, a placement clearly meant to humiliate me in front of colleagues. She was officially terminated on April 11. Montgomery alleges the investigation that led to her filing stemmed from complaints that the city's officer promotion system is biased against black applicants, though she claims she, quote, had no responsibility for the development of administration of the matrix, unquote. Her filing contends she was treated more severely than two white senior officers who were more directly involved with the promotional process. A white assistant chief, accused of taking unauthorized payments, kept his badge and gun when placed on leave, while Montgomery's were immediately confiscated. The filing reads, and a white deputy chief sanctioned for supervisory failures related to the promotion protocols only received verbal counseling. Montgomery's attorney, Arthur Davis of HKM Employment Attorneys, characterized Montgomery as, quote, a remarkable law enforcement professional who has fallen victim to a double standard that is quick to judge, punish, and fire black officers, unquote. The filing cites statistics claiming black officers face disproportionate discipline at DPD. According to these figures, while black officers make up less than a quarter of the force, they receive 41% of disciplinary actions. And in the past decade, nearly 70% of black officers currently employed by DPD have received some form of discipline, compared to 25% of white officers currently on the force. The filing also attributes Montgomery's termination in part to retaliation for obtaining legal representation. In late November of 24, while on forced leave, Montgomery retained counsel who sent letters to city officials outlining potential discrimination claims. It looks I'm just going in terms of recent history in the Indy Week. I've got quite a few back articles that I can count on if I need to. This one is about a Raleigh software engineer who will lose her job in medical research due to these cuts in USAID. After working for private sector companies like Cisco and IBM, Raleigh resident Paige Sullivan took a position as a software engineer on an orthopedic trauma research team at Johns Hopkins University 5 years ago. The job came with good benefits, including the option to work remotely, but also a $40,000 pay cut. Sullivan felt it was worth it. Quote, "I wanted to do something in my career for the greater good, bigger than me, not just working to make somebody else, some shareholder, more money. I wanted to do something to give back. That's just who I am." As a programmer analyst for the Bloomberg School of Public Health, Sullivan oversees the operation of a software system where data for various studies from the Major Extremity Trauma Research Consortium, that's METRC, hosted at Johns Hopkins, is entered and stored. Researchers then analyze that data with the goal of publishing their findings. Most of the studies are funded with U.S. Department of Defense, DOD, grants, and Metric, founded in 2009 with funding from the DOD, works with more than 80 civilian and military trauma centers on research for orthopedic trauma studies. One of the studies focused on how to prevent blood clots from forming following a broken leg. Another looked at using antibiotic powders in wounds to prevent infections. The studies were geared toward soldiers who sustain injuries in combat, says Sullivan, but the public nature of the research means that their findings also benefit civilians. Many of the study's findings are now practically applied. But Sullivan doesn't work on the medical side. She explains, "My responsibility is I maintain the computer system that all the research data goes into. During the collection process, people log in, fill out a form. We ask them all these questions about the patient, how they're healing, what kind of injury they had." On May the 12th, Sullivan's position will end. One of the casualties of the federal government's cuts to the U.S. Agency for International Development. She's not sure how the work will continue after she and some of her other team members are gone. "I stay busy," she says. "Every research study is a little different, so there's a question about who's going to make those changes, add those modifications into the software system. I'm just handing it off to my boss, spending the next 4 weeks just documenting everything." Sullivan's expertise is with the REDCap, which is a system software that was created at Vanderbilt University, and Sullivan says she wants to find a position where she can keep using it. But the National Institutes of Health provide funding for development and ongoing support of REDCap, so Sullivan wonders if that will eventually go away too. She's looking for a new job, but says competition is steep and more federal government layoffs won't help the situation. Once her position ends, she can file for unemployment, but those benefits are paltry, $350 a week for just 12 weeks. They won't cover her monthly child support payment. She says it's just one more thing. It would be nice to have a break. I thought I did have one. Everything in work was going great. Everything in my life was lining up, and then the rug gets pulled out from underneath me. While she's looking for a new job, Sullivan, who is transgender, plans to channel her energy into advocacy work and opposing state-level attacks on LGBTQ rights, reproductive rights, DEI, and free speech. When we meet, says the author, she's on her way to a committee hearing at the legislature to speak out against House Bill 636, a book banning bill named, quote, Promoting Wholesome Content for Students. Sullivan says she plans on being at the General Assembly a lot this summer as time allows. Quote, I'm looking for a job. It's going to take time, so why not? I've been saying for years, if you want to make a change, you've got to go out and do it yourself. Get down there. Now, Jane Porter has filed this story, how a triangle history teacher is keeping a Holocaust survivor story alive. This survivor, Abe Piasek, said, keep telling my story to his friend Steve Goldberg, a Triangle school teacher in January 2020, shortly before he died. It was a charge Goldberg would take to heart in ways that sometimes seem surprising, even to himself. Piasek was 91 years old and under hospice care. He and Goldberg had met 2 years earlier when Goldberg, then a U.S. history teacher at the Research Triangle High School, introduced Piasek as a speaker to four classes of students in the Students' Black Box Theater. Piasek spoke to the students for 45 minutes each and made an impression on them and on Goldberg. Piasek had been speaking to communities across the state after moving to North Carolina in 2009, and Goldberg had looked him up and sent information out to the school community about him. The school principal asked Goldberg to introduce Piasek to the students as a speaker. Goldberg recalls, I was just taken by his personality, his energy. There was something about him reminding me a little bit of my grandfather. Feeling 45 minutes wasn't enough time to fully understand his life story, Goldberg interviewed Piasek at his home in Raleigh, where they spoke for more than 2 hours. Piasek told Goldberg about his life in Białobrzegi, Poland, where he lived with his parents and younger sister. He was 11 when the Nazis invaded, 13 when he was separated from his family. He never saw them again. Piasek worked in three slave camps from 1942 to 45, including Auschwitz in 1944. In 1945, April, Piasek was liberated from a cattle car at age 16 and came to the U.S. in 47. He worked as a baker, lived in Connecticut, California, Florida, and finally North Carolina, where he moved with his wife, Shirley, to be close to his daughter, Pam. Piasek also does have a son, Joe, who lives in New York. It wasn't until much later in his life that Piasek began talking about his experience during the Holocaust after agreeing to an interview with the Shoah Foundation. On the day they spoke at Piasek's house, Goldberg mentioned he was traveling with his class to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. Piasek, who had never visited the museum before, offered to accompany the students and two of his own great-granddaughters on the trip. At the museum, Piasek wanted to see a cattle car on exhibit on the third floor. When he got there, he stood in the cattle car and narrated his liberation from a similar container decades earlier. He recalled, I was getting chills. Imagine going to a place where it's totally evocative in smell, look, and feel, a place where you had unbelievable trauma when you were 15, 16 years old. That's what he did. And he did that so the students and his great-granddaughters would have this experience that they are never going to forget. Goldberg says Piasek had a knack for connecting with the students he spoke to. He never used notes and spoke from memory, reading the audience and speaking in ways that drew them in. Often he was one of the students' first introductions to the history of the Holocaust, a warm, captivating speaker with a powerful story who commanded their attention and inspired them to ask questions. There never seemed to be enough time to answer them all. As a teacher himself, Goldberg feels that those constraints on Piaget's speaking time and on teachers more generally who are tasked with teaching such a significant period in modern history are unfortunate. Goldberg wants to do justice to Piaget's story and legacy and says he realized the best way to do that was to keep Piaget the main focus. Now, Goldberg travels around the state telling Piaget's story at schools and libraries, synagogues, community centers, companies, colleges, and universities. He uses the elements of Piaget's own storytelling, plus video clips of Piaget himself, to forge the same connection that Piaget made with his listeners. Students have sent Goldberg letters after his talks, and Piaget's story has inspired art and other student projects. Telling this story, says Goldberg, has become his full-time job, and he's shared it 145 times with nearly 8,000 people so far. He's also working on a book about the work he's been doing. This year marked the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, and it's not lost on Goldberg that soon there won't be any Holocaust survivors still living. Second and third generation descendants of survivors are organizing to tell their stories, and Goldberg hopes that, in addition to their efforts, his work can be another model for how that history is preserved, and that young people, especially, could learn about the Holocaust through Piaget's experience. Goldberg also recognizes the precariousness of the times we're living through. Piaget had a simple message, don't hate. But Goldberg takes it further. Quote, there are a lot of parallels between the events that led to the Holocaust and the rise in antisemitism, and you're seeing a rise of authoritarian regimes that are not respecting human rights today. And so, it feels like this is a moment when Abe's story really matters. All right, and we'll change gears to Indie Selects. That's a fairly new feature where the couple of editors of Indie look through calendars of things coming up for this week and just make their own personal selection of what they think would be either improving, enjoyful, or all of the above, enjoyful. All right, and what might you do today, Thursday, April 24th? Well, since you won't hear this until April 25th, I'm not going to read that. But I can read something about to do. An event called Fairest Creatures, and I've participated in this a couple of different times, and it's the Complete Sonnets of William Shakespeare. That'll be Saturday, the 26th, and Sunday, the April 27th, at Burning Coal Theater in downtown Raleigh. 1 p.m. both those days. Shakespeare nerds across the triangle know that the Bard's birthday falls this week, or fell on April the 23rd. And for the 10th year, Pequod Productions and Burning Coal are celebrating with their annual reading all 154 of Shakespeare's sonnets in person on Saturday and virtually on Sunday. So block out a couple of hours this weekend. Head over to Burning Coal Theater for the live reading beginning at 1 p.m. Leave any time. Drop in to hear readers recite or perform one sonnet, with the option of adding an additional minute to enhance their reading. Now, some of these enhancements have included reciting the sonnet in another language. I still remember the Klingon. I can't remember what sonnet that was. Adding music, puppets, or another performance element, or the reader talking about what the chosen sonnet means to them. On Sunday, also at 1, you could tune in to a virtual Zoom session for readings of the second half of those sonnets, which will be broadcast on Facebook Live. No admission. Then, a Sunday, April 27th, Eat at Landon Estates in Clayton. Roots for Reese's Chef's Picnic. Blake Gottlieb, childhood best friend Reese Byrd, passed away from a heroin overdose. Gottlieb, a survivor himself and now the chef and owner of the Smithfield Company Under the Oak Catering, has made it his mission to promote awareness and actionable change around opiate addiction ever since. Annual event Roots for Reese Chef's Picnic, now in its seventh year, raises money for the North Carolina Harm Reduction Coalition. That's an organization that distributes life-saving supplies like naloxone. The event brings together more than a dozen chefs from across the Triangle and Piedmont, including Jake Wood from Lawrence Barbecue, Katrina Sudnor, the Umstead Hotel, Eric Montaigne, Local Seafood, many more, alongside beverage makers like Trophy Brewing and Neuse River Brewing. Tickets start at $100. This is not a cheap event, but it is one where all proceeds go directly toward harm reduction across the state. By the way, VIP tickets are also available. I think you could look up Roots for Reese, R-E-E-C-E, Chef's Picnic, or Landon Estates in Clayton, 1 to 6 p.m. on Sunday. Now, how about attending some high-powered music, for example, Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto? Sunday, April 24th or 27th, various times. 5, Carolina Ballet performances unspool this week across these evening and matinee concertos that feature live music from the Chamber Orchestra of the Triangle. And in addition to that, immerse yourself in this sweeping Tchaikovsky classic is reason enough to turn out to Raleigh Memorial Auditorium this week, but the performances also mark another important milestone. That is the retirement of ballerina Margaret Severin Hansen, a founding member of the Carolina Ballet and Company principal since 2002. Across decades, her focus, grace, and technical agility have been a cornerstone at Carolina Ballet, and the Sunday matinee marks her final performance with the company. For ballet lovers in the Triangle, this show is a triumphant moment that cannot be missed, writes Sarah Edwards. And I would imagine you could look up the North Carolina Symphony at Memorial Auditorium or the Carolina Ballet, which might be the orchestra in question there, not the symphony. I'm not sure. So that is to attend. And then the last one on this little event is Tuesday, April 29 at 5:30 p.m. over at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, David Graham's work, The Project. While it would be nice to never hear the phrase Project 2025 ever again, current reality suggests it's not currently possible. Perhaps the better tack, if we want to fight against it, is to learn more about the far right's 900-page blueprint for President Trump's second term. In the project, Atlantic staff writer and Durham resident David Graham unpacks Project 25, taking a closer look at some of its core ideological beliefs that haven't been quite as emphasized yet amid the dizzying takedown of the federal workforce, an obsession with the nuclear family and patriarchal gender roles, and an unprotected workforce under the thumb of deregulated corporations, also targeting local media. Unpleasant stuff to familiarize yourself with, to be sure, but given the administration's success so far in rapidly constructing an authoritarian state, these are not details you want to sleep on. Topic-by-topic guide, The Project, publishes April the 22nd. And so that's already gone by. Graham will be in conversation about the book with Frank Bruni for this Flyleaf signing and talk, which is Tuesday, April the 29th, at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. I'll go ahead and call my next article a cultural music-related article, and it is. And it's about the Triangle's Raging Grannies. Chloe Bull wrote this. We need a gentle anger. Even in a crowd of thousands, they're instantly recognizable by sight and sound. Silver-haired women wearing colorful aprons and floppy hats, brandishing cardboard signs, sheafs of lyrics, singing acerbic protest songs set to cheerful nursery tunes. We were angry when you raised all those taxes on the poor. We were outraged when you authorized those pipelines. Our infrastructure's gone to pot. Our grandkids are getting shot. So we're raging, because now you've pissed off Grandma. The Raging Grannies originated in Canada in 1987 following the Chernobyl nuclear power plant explosion the year prior. Their first ever protest, staged in Victoria, British Columbia, involved an umbrella punched through with holes, a dig at the idea of protection beneath a nuclear umbrella, and a broken-hearted un-Valentine delivered to an unsympathetic member of Parliament, accompanied by a satirical lullaby. Today, there are more than 50 groups of grannies. In their vernacular, they call themselves gaggles. Gaggles of grannies spread across Canada and the United States. They protest peacefully against injustices in their communities and farther afield, from war to political corruption to environmental degradation. The gaggles operate independently of each other, but they do share song lyrics and a penchant for loud, gaudy outfits. Vicky Ryder, who joined the Triangle Raging Grannies more than a decade ago, and is one of the most prolific songwriters, says, "We're mocking the stereotype. We're going to look like what you think grandmothers look like, but when we open our mouths, we're going to make you sit up and take notice." Long before she became a raging granny or moved to Durham, she was a school-aged daughter of activist parents in New York. She says, "When I was born in 1942, my parents named me Vicky for a quick victory over fascism. From the day I was born, it was my job to fight fascism, and that's what I've been doing. As I grew older and I had children and grandchildren, I wanted this world to be more welcoming to them and more gentle." Ryder's father, a member of the New York City Teachers Union, was blacklisted during the McCarthy period for his union organizing efforts. It was a formative time for Ryder, who was only 10. She recalls FBI agents following her and her brother around the city, throwing them up against cars, questioning them about their parents. She says, "This has not been, for me, a friendly country. I've never perceived it as a country where the government was really working in the interests of the people." Thanks to her father's organizing connections, Ryder grew up around musician activists like Pete Seeger and Paul Robeson. She paid her way through college by giving guitar lessons and spent her Sunday afternoons singing folk songs in Washington Square. Decades later, she would channel her folk music background into writing lyrics for the Raging Grannies. She founded a gaggle in Rochester, New York in 2002. The first rage she organized was against proposed cuts to the public library budget. The following week, when then New York Senator Hillary Clinton visited Rochester, Ryder and her fellow grannies raged outside the federal building to protest Clinton's support of the Iraq War. She has not slowed down since. As she moved around, she started gag holds in South Florida and Central Florida before joining the Triangle Gaggle. She's written hundreds of songs since 2002 because, quote, "every week there seems to be something else to rage about." "Now you've pissed off Grandma," which continues for six more verses, criticizing gerrymandering, book banning, and Christian nationalism, is a writer original. Like all of her songs, she adjusts it depending on the cause and encourages other grannies to make it their own. For the hands-off rally at the state capitol earlier this month, she wrote two new songs, "Raging for Social Security." "Social Security's easily fixed, hooray, hooray. Just lift the cap that protects the rich today, today." And DEMOCRACY, "We have some news for our president. Monarchy's simply passé." you won't hear Donald Trump's name in the lyrics. It didn't start with Trump, says Ryder, and is not going to end with him. Getting rid of Trump is not going to get rid of the problem. We still have racism that is allowed. We still have poverty that is allowed. We will still have environmental destruction that is allowed by the courts, allowed by the Congress, and it's allowed by the media. Her activism is a full-time commitment. What has suffered, I think she says, is time with my grandchildren. They know what I do. They respect me for it. I've apologized to them over and over by saying, I know I'm not spending as much time with you as we both would like, but I'm doing this for you. I'm 82 years old, but you're the ones who are going to have to live with what we leave for you, and this is my way of showing my love for you. And they understand that. Another Triangle Raging Granny, Libby Johnson, also has decades worth of activism under her belt. While working as a nurse practitioner and social worker in Alabama during the civil rights movement, Johnson met her husband, Eric, a Presbyterian minister. They were both politically active, committed to anti-nuclear and anti-imperialist causes. She and Eric frequently moved their five children between congregations and states. And she said, we would last about 6 or 7 years before they said, you're too radical. She encouraged her kids to care about peace and justice, sending one to the Soviet Union for a fellowship of reconciliation and bringing them all to protests against the Gulf War. While living in Tennessee in the 2000s, Johnson and her husband became heavily involved in protests against the Y-12 nuclear weapons plant in Oak Ridge, which produced the uranium used in the atomic bomb the U.S. dropped on Hiroshima. Each year, on the anniversary of the bombing, the Johnsons helped to organize mass protests at Y-12. Thousands of people came, including Buddhist monks from Atlanta and Raging Grannies from Michigan. Johnson recalls, the Raging Grannies impressed me so much with their lyrics at these rallies that I said, when I retire, when I have a chance, I'm going to join. The protesters carried coffins, lay down in the street, chained themselves to the gates of the plant to keep it from opening. The Johnsons were both arrested several times for their nonviolent actions at Y-12. The plant continues to enrich uranium and produce and store nuclear weapons to this day. In 2015, Johnson and her husband moved to Durham to be closer to two of their grandchildren, and she made good on her promise to become a Raging Granny. She says, I don't believe we've ever seen America this chaotic, this inhumane. I ask her how she feels about that and why she's continued to organize and protest for all these years. She replies, there's a song I like by Holly Near. She sings the opening line for me. We are gentle, angry people, and we're singing for our lives. She says, I think anger is necessary, and so you will see me with my fist up. We need a gentle anger. And parenthetically, the Triangle Raging Granny's next gig, April the 26th, at the Haw River Assembly's Climate Action Fair over in Pittsburgh, April the 26th, Raging Granny's. My longest article by far is by Barry Yeoman, and it was released on the 19th of the month, and it's called Amid an Unprecedented Immigration Crackdown, Durham Tries to Hold the Line. I'll read about as much of this as time permits. Isabel Guzman dispensed with the niceties as she scanned the faces inside a church fellowship hall in Durham. The crowd of mostly immigrants had arrived in winter pullovers and windbreakers, anxious about the news, wondering how much the coming years would disrupt their lives. It was January 19th, the day before Donald Trump's inauguration. The upcoming administration had promised to, quote, unleash the vast arsenal of federal powers against both undocumented immigrants and those with temporary authorization. There would be workplace raids, sprawling camps, fast-track deportations that circumvented due process. And there would be consequences for jurisdictions like Durham County, which Trump's allies had criticized as sanctuary strongholds. What's more, state legislatures had recently passed a law requiring sheriffs to cooperate with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. House Bill 10 targeted officials like Durham County Sheriff Clarence Burkhead, who had refused to honor detainers, which are voluntary requests to hold undocumented inmates up to 48 hours beyond their scheduled release so that ICE can collect them for deportation. It was a perplexing moment for the 60 people who had gathered at the fellowship hall, so Guzman, an immigration attorney, came prepared with precise, distilled advice. Above everything, she warned, do not let federal officers into your home without a warrant signed by a judge. She said, I've been doing this since 2008. I have never seen an ICE officer with a real warrant. They may try to trick you with some sheet of paper with Mickey Mouse on it. That's not a warrant. Parents need to prepare, she said, and part of that is training your very, very trusting and innocent children not to open the door at 6 o'clock in the morning when ICE enjoys surprising you. Toddlers crawled at the feet of their parents, who sat at circular tables and listened through translation earphones as Guzman acknowledged the support team in the room. Standing in a corner were Ivan Almonte, a Mexican-born community organizer, and the Reverend Ricardo Santiago Medina, a priest originally from Cuba. Sharing the dais with Guzman was Sheriff Burkhead, a Democrat, first elected in 2018 on a pledge not to voluntarily aid federal deportation efforts. Burkhead, dressed in a bow tie, told the audience that ICE agents could still stake out his jail and ambush inmates as they're released, but he would not make it easy. He described a strained meeting with ICE employees 11 days earlier, their first and only during his 6 years in office. They asked me, so, Sheriff, if someone is about to be released from your jail and the detainer is about to expire, will you call us and let us know? He said, what was my answer? No, responded a few members of the audience. No, because that's not what the law says. No, I will not call ICE. The lawyer, organizer, priest, and the sheriff unified in their effort to buffer local immigrants from the new administration's enforcement blitz. If any county could, it would be Durham, which gave Trump just 18% of the vote last year and has a 100-year history of civil rights activism. While Durham's local governments have not adopted formal sanctuary policies, which state law prohibits, its officials have been outspoken for years in their embrace of immigrants who make up 15% of the county population. But would moral conviction, teamwork, and supportive local law enforcement suffice? If the team had a captain, it would be Almonte, who describes himself as the 9/11 of Durham's immigrant community. Almonte founded and leads Respuesta Rápida de Durham, rapid response network that verifies and posts reports of missing children, school gas leaks, and police checkpoints. Its Facebook page tracks federal and state legislation and posts local announcements, too, like chicken dinner fundraisers for funeral expenses. Almonte fields late-night phone calls, often from individuals in distress. His first such call of the new administration came on January 26th from a fiancé of an asylum seeker whom ICE arrested outside a discount store in Raleigh. Almonte also meets with organizers from across the state to strategize a response to the new state and federal policies, and he has stayed in close contact with Burkhead since the sheriff's first campaign 7 years ago. He is still quick to point out that he views their ongoing discussions as a mechanism to hold the sheriff accountable, saying, there is no friendship here. This community organizing is volunteer work for the 46-year-old on top of his paid job in mental health care. It's hard to miss Almonte in his Santa hat at Christmas posadas or tending to his elaborate altar at Day of the Dead festivals each fall. A quarter century of community service has garnered him a deep well of respect. Guzman, the attorney, says, when Ivan asks, I jump. In the week after Trump's inauguration, Almonte had to navigate a whole new legal landscape. The president had signed a thick docket of executive orders, proclamations, declaring an invasion at the southern border, shutting down asylum and refugee admissions, and deploying the military to repel illegal immigration. The Department of Homeland Security green-lighted arrests in sensitive areas like schools and churches. The media reported raids in Newark, Boston, and Chicago. Amid this fire hose of information, a rumor began circulating online that ICE had raided two Durham grocery stores that serve Latino shoppers. This turned out to be false. Someone had dressed up like an immigration officer and painted an SUV to resemble a Border Patrol vehicle. But the report was convincing enough to set off a panic. Customers jammed the phone lines at one of the stores. Almonte's own phone pinged with calls, texts, and WhatsApp messages. I was like, man, this is not real. And people found out it was a hoax. But that scared people off the streets. On January 29, Almonte logged into a virtual meeting of Latin 19, a consortium of health professionals, educators, grassroots leaders, and others that originally formed to address health disparities in North Carolina during the pandemic. The threat of mass deportations, he told the 70 people online, was already proving corrosive, saying, people are canceling appointments. People are not going to grocery stores. I've talked to a lot of Latino businesses, and they say, like, it's empty. Almonte had just returned from Charlotte. He had risen before sunrise to drive a Durham asylum seeker who had fled gang violence in Honduras and was the sole caretaker of his 8-year-old daughter for a routine immigration check-in at a government contractor's office. It was an anxious trip. Trump's new deportation policy meant the man could be arrested and detained at the check-in. The normally busy waiting room was nearly vacant. People were scared that obeying the law could get them deported. They'd also passed a construction site near the office where they are typically immigrant workers. That place is empty now, he said. They had to stop the construction there, the labor there, because nobody's showing up. As the Latin 19 meeting progressed, it grew rawer and more personal. Some attendees were themselves in danger of family separation. A mother of two young daughters said, my husband works in construction, and when he leaves, when he walks out the door, it's like having Jesus in the mouth, a phrase that suggests living with fear. If they call you at a time when they don't usually call you, your heart races, and a thousand things come to you in a second. What we're living, for me, is not a life. It's not the dream that I imagine. The following Sunday, the congregants at Durham's Iglesia Episcopal Buen Pastor, Church of the Good Shepherd, lined up to greet Father Medina. The bespectacled 56-year-old met each with a smile before wrapping them in his white vestment, whispering a blessing. Young children shouting in Spanish ran between the pews, corralled by parents with varying degrees of success. Most members were dressed in button-down and dresses, their hair neatly combed and sprayed or gelled. More than 140 people had come to celebrate Dia de la Candelaria, or Candlemas, which marks the day Mary and Joseph first brought Jesus to the temple in Jerusalem. As part of the festivities, believers brought in figurines of baby Jesus from their Christmas nativity scenes. Several families dressed their figurines in new clothing, an annual tradition, and placed them at the altars for Medina to bless. Medina moved to Durham in November of 2022 after the church's previous priest died of a heart attack. He recalled how difficult it was attracting people on Sundays, as many had grown accustomed to attending Mass online during the pandemic. Determined to change this, he tended closely to his flock, for example, visiting the grieving family during the 9 days of prayer that follow Mexican funerals. Over 2 years, in-person attendance increased roughly fivefold. Recently, however, those numbers were trending downwards. People are very afraid, he said, especially the people of our congregation. It is a truly immigrant congregation. He worries that the lower attendance at church and other shared spaces will isolate community members. It's been a central theme of his conversations with Almonte, who he met shortly after arriving in Durham. They had lunch, and Medina was impressed by Almonte's work. Medina recalled, "I told him, look, don't lose contact with me. I'm going to support you in everything I can." After Medina concluded his sermon, he descended from the pulpit to make an announcement. The church would be moving communications away from its public Facebook page. Instead, important messages would be transmitted privately through WhatsApp. Church leaders no longer felt it safe to publicize the location of services or weekly food distribution for fear of tipping off ICE. There had even been talk of shutting down the social media altogether, but they didn't want to lose the record of the church's history. Medina said, "I feel a lot of pain because we are working practically in a clandestine way." Secrecy in the face of prosecution is familiar to Medina, who left Cuba for the United States more than a decade ago. His work there, organizing religious celebrations, maintaining an independent pharmacy, advocating for free speech, and distributing clothing, resulted in stiff fines and even death threats, and he was imprisoned in 2005 for protesting speech restrictions. He was released after 15 months following advocacy from his family, international Catholic bishops, and foreign governments, including the United States. Now he finds himself working in the shadows again. "I feel like I'm living the same thing," he said. Medina recognizes he doesn't have a choice. He and other priests have instructed the congregation to remove rosaries and religious images from their cars to prevent potential profiling on the road. The church is also working with notaries and immigration lawyers to develop free legal documents providing for children's care in the event their parents are deported. Durham's first publicized sweep came early on February 13th. Residents of Northgate Park noticed unfamiliar cars and trucks circling their mid-century neighborhood. The vehicles converged at a house where several immigrants from India were living. Neighbors watched as masked federal officers carrying guns and tasers led away three men in handcuffs. One woman filmed the arrest and shared the video with a local TV station. "Do you all have a signed order from the judge that I can see?" she called out as the officers led one of the men down the driveway. The officers didn't respond. The one seemed to flash a thumbs up. Early news and social media suggest the officers worked for ICE, which enforces immigration in the country's interior. But the following day, a different agency, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which typically monitors the borders and port, took credit for arresting 11 illegal aliens in a target enforcement operation in Durham. Those arrested, it said, were being held at a federal detention facility and awaited deportation hearings. Local officials were livid. "The feds, quite frankly, kidnap members of our community," said Durham City Council member Javier Caballero at the next week's meeting. The sweep was a reminder of the restraints on a sheriff's power in the face of conflicting federal policy. Burkett said he didn't learn about the arrest until his communication team saw the video on social media. Nor did he hear from Customs and Border Protection afterwards. "We were in the dark like everyone else," he said in an interview with the Assembly 2 weeks later. "To this day, I don't have any reliable information on exactly what took place, who was apprehended or detained. None of that." No matter how much local and federal officials disagree, they are intertwined legally, technologically, and financially. When someone gets booked for a crime at a county jail, their fingerprints are automatically transmitted to the federal government, which checks them against an immigration database. Moreover, localities can apply for federal grants from the State Criminal Alien Assistance Program, SCAAP, to offset the cost of incarcerating undocumented immigrants with felony or multiple misdemeanor convictions. During the Biden administration's, recipients were not required to cooperate with ICE, for example, by honoring detainers. But critics cautioned that the money might still encourage biased policing by making it cheaper for local law enforcement to detain non-citizens. In January, Biden's Department of Justice awarded Durham County's $124,000 in SCAP funds. Birkhead recognized that federal agents were not obligated to notify him about their actions in his country, in his county, excuse me. Still, he wished someone had at least tipped him off with a phone call. Frustration is an emotion I'll share, he said, and a disappointment in our federal partners who continue to refuse to communicate and even attempt to develop a relationship with local law enforcement. Customs and Border Protection spokesman told the assembly in an email that federal officers tried to call the nearest Durham City Police Station, but not the county sheriff, before making the arrest, and no one answered. The lack of communication also concerned Birkhead from a safety perspective. For one, the sheriff worried about friendly fire between officers from one agency and plainclothes officers or detectives from another, as if his detectives do not know when and where the feds are making arrests. Birkhead also worried about the impact on his agency's work if immigrants fear coming forward when they experience or witness a crime. Brisley, the spokesperson, declined to comment on those concerns. The sheriff has reassured residents that his deputies won't ask people their immigration status and that he won't go beyond the narrowest interpretation of House Bill 10. But those promises offer limited comfort when masked federal agents can swoop into a neighborhood. He said it certainly could drive a wedge between law enforcement and the community, and that's not good for public safety. Well, there's much more of this article to read, but I have no more time to read it to you. You can find the complete article and all these articles I've read, including links, at IndyWeek.com if you should choose to do so. I'll be back, I believe, next Thursday or next Friday for the next issue. And Indie Week, this broadcast, will go into our podcast section of the ncreadingservice.org. Thanks very much for listening to John Federson read the Indie Week. Bye-bye.